The Bob Murphy Show, episode 319.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Hey everybody, welcome back to The Bob Murphy Show. We're going to have a comprehensive episode for you right now. Going to revisit the intelligent design topic. So specifically what happened was somebody recommended to another podcaster, who I won't name, that he have me on his show, and he said something like, yeah, you got to get Bob Murphy on to discuss all the ID stuff. At this point, he can basically prove the existence of God mathematically, something like that. And the host was like, oh, yeah, because he's been doing a lot of episodes. And I said, yeah, come on. So I tempered expectations, and I said, I don't think it's correct to say I can prove it mathematically, but yeah, there is a lot of stuff here. And so then I just started going and just doing a deep dive back in the ID stuff. I found some podcasts where that's all they do and stuff that the Discovery Institute put out. And I just immersed myself back in that genre again to get ready for this. And then that guy put his podcast on hiatus. And so yeah, so well, geez, I just crammed for 3 weeks getting ready for this thing. And I, oh, you know what? I'll just do it on the Bob Murphy Show. And so here's what we'll do. And I can, you know, control the flow of the information here better because I didn't know what questions the other guy was going to ask me. So maybe if you think about it, maybe this all came together for a reason and that's why it all happened the way it did, as if it were intelligently designed. How about that? Okay. So cuteness aside, let's go ahead and get into it. First of all, let me just address, so let me explain, take a step back. What am I trying to accomplish here? If you're someone who is a devout atheist, and there is such a thing, because I called myself that when I was an undergrad, and you think intelligent design is a Trojan horse, it's gobbledygook pseudoscience at best from a bunch of lying, deceitful Christians who are trying to ram religion down an poor school kids' throats, and this is their clever way to circumvent the laws against teaching religion in school. I'm not going to convince you in this episode, and I'm not trying to. Okay. What I am going to do, though, is explain to both Christians and even, you know, agnostics who aren't particularly hot tempered about it that there are serious, legitimate scientific inquiries being made here, that this is a legitimate field of study. A few years ago, I had Winston Ewart on my show, this, you know, the Bob Murphy Show, and he's actually now one of the up-and-coming names in this field. He recently was a co-author on William Densky's reissue of one of his classic works in the intelligent design field, and I think I said it when I had Winston on, or I maybe said it like nearby that episode. Maybe I did like my own personal solo episode on ID at the time because it was, you know, my discussion with Winston had prompted it. I can't remember the exact details, but I made the analogy and said intelligent design is the something like the public choice of biology or something like that. Okay, and I had, at the time, a few atheist, free market economics / libertarian fans emailing me and said, Bob, stop discrediting, you know, libertarianism and public choice economics and free market economics by linking it to this pseudoscience gobbledygook. And I think intelligent design, the longer time passes, the more reputable it gets, and the more seriously people are going to start taking it. Now, it's not that they're going to necessarily hold up the pioneers in this field and say they're great. I don't know if that's going to happen. I mean, if you go and look, I'm going to go over three guys just to give you a little bit of heads up on what we're doing. I'm going to just give you a crash course in some of the contributions from Michael Behe, William Dembski, and Stephen Meyer. And then I'll, you know, put a bunch of links. So this is bobmurphyshow.com/319. This is basically going to, among other functions, be like a quick digest for you, then go do further reading if I've whetted your appetite for this stuff. Okay. And so from what I'm going to tell you, and then if you go and watch some of these, you know, interviews or listen to the podcasts with these guys and just hear them talk, and you can see these are serious guys. They're very smart. They're very well informed. They don't set up straw men. They're raising deep questions. They're familiar with the literature. They understand, you know, what the standard orthodox views are in these areas. And then if you went and looked at their Wikipedia entries and what absolute hit jobs those entries are, I mean, it's shocking. Okay, so there's such hostility to them. I'm not necessarily saying that 5 years from now or even 10 years from now, atheist biologists are going to look back and say, oh yeah, those guys at the Discovery Institute were actually onto something. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying the kind of things they're chipping away at and the points they're making, I think, are going to end up getting absorbed into more mainstream chemistry and even biology departments. It might take time, but I think it will, because partly what's going on, I'm going to be jumping around a little bit here, but just to give you a glimpse of where we're going, is there are a lot of not advances, but the application of standard results from computer science, or what you might call information theory, to the realm of biology. And the results are not good for the standard Darwinian model. All right, so that's partly what's going on here. So it's not even so much that standard biology, left to its own devices, would change, but I think they're going to get forced into a position where these outsiders coming from physics and computer science and then even chemistry to an extent are going to encroach on what has traditionally been the biological turf, and they're not going to be able to just keep appealing and saying, oh, well, these guys are idiots and they don't know how science works. I mean, these other people are going to come in and say, well, no, the way we do science over here in chemistry, or the information, you know, computer scientists are going to come over and say, well, no, the way we do computer science is da, 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 da. And so you see how your approach doesn't make any sense from our paradigm. And then you can't just say, well, you guys are a bunch of Bible thumpers if it's a bunch of, you know, rigorous computer scientists. Okay, so that's kind of what's going on, or that's part of what's going on here. Okay, so the term itself, intelligent design, as the name suggests, it's the theory, it's intelligent design theory, that the way to explain, or part of the explanation for certain patterns that we see, certainly in the biological realm, and then others would extend it to say even, you know, the natural universe itself, that there is the unmistakable mark of a designer, that it seems there is a mind at work. All right. And so, as you can imagine, a lot of Christians, especially those who are very scientifically inclined, embrace this. And then, as you can also imagine, or you don't need to imagine if you've read the stuff, that's one of the chief moves of the opponents of this, is to say this is just a Trojan horse. All this is a bunch of people who believe in the biblical creation story of Genesis, and they're dressing it up with this pseudoscientific garb so it looks like it's science, but it's not. All right, and so let me just talk about that for a minute. One easy way to show that that's not exactly correct, that there is a distinction between old school creationism, or what we might call like special creationism, and especially like people coming from biblical literalists who, for example, believe in a literal 6-day creation, and that the earth is only, like, you call it the young earth creationists, and they think like the earth is only like 6,000 years old. And where that comes from is if you, you know, go through Genesis and you count up the generations, or like in the gospel accounts of Jesus, like it gives the genealogy of Jesus. Okay, and so if you go through and you start counting up using the Bible, the generations starting with Adam and Eve, and then going up through, and for some of the generations, there's like long time spans, right? Like some of the people back in the day, according to the Bible, lived to be, you know, many hundreds of years old. But even taking all that into account, that it's only like 6,000 years have passed from the creation of the universe until, you know, modern times, like the time of Jesus, whatever. And so there are some Christians who believe that. But I'm saying that is not what the ID movement is just like a smokescreen for. And that's real obvious to prove that because, for example, I think most of the people associated with the ID movement, certainly most of its prominent leaders in terms of like the intellectual firepower behind it, do not agree with a young earth, right? They think the universe is billions of years old. And Michael Behe, for example, who's one of the one of the early pioneers in this movement, he's a biochemist, and I'm going to talk about him in a second here. But he, for example, my understanding is he doesn't even have a problem with evolution. He doesn't even have a problem with the theory of common descent. Okay, so he's okay saying today, if we looked around all the different variety of life that we see in the biosphere, it all shares a common ancestor, that we could trace it back ultimately to a single cell that was the first cell on Earth, and that all life descended from that one cell. Okay, so that's clearly not saying on the first day God created this, and then he created this, and then he created this, and then finally he made man, and then pulled a rib out, and there was Eve, and there you go. And so clearly, hey, humans don't come from monkeys, you satanic monster. Right, that's clearly not where Michael Behe is coming from. All right, so he's okay with evolution. He's okay saying, even okay with common descent. But he's saying the mechanism by which that happened, the standard orthodox Darwinian account, is inadequate to explain that. All right, and now I know some of you maybe, if you've never heard this stuff before, getting like cynical, like, oh, so you're basically conceding that the biologists are basically right. You're just quibbling about like the philosophy. What does it mean? No, I'm telling you, resist the temptation to do that. Or if you want to do that, fine, go ahead. But I'm saying, I think as more time passes, more and more scientific people are going to, and I don't just mean like people who like science and think Star Trek's cool. I'm saying like practicing professional scientists, more and more of them are going to come around and realize that, yes, there are serious issues with the old school standard Darwinian account. Okay. So, let me just mention another thing. I'm going to come back to this when I talk about Stephen Meyer, but another example, I don't want to forget this, is one of the trump cards from the people in the ID movement is the fact that the universe had an origin, and they point to the Big Bang as evidence in their favor. And that might surprise you because you might be used to debates, ostensibly between science and religion. I think that's a false dichotomy, but you know, that's the way it's framed very conveniently for the scientists. And you might be used to biblical literalists, you know, who don't trust those pointy-headed professors coming from the big universities up there in the city, and you don't know how to change a tire, do you? I don't even know what accent I'm doing there, but you get the idea.
And you might be thinking that, like, oh, yeah, you believe in the Big Bang, that everything just blew up. And then, yeah, there was like some star or something that blew up. And everywhere. Well, who made the star? God made that, right? And, anyway, no, I know that it was the Genesis accounts, right? And it wasn't the Big Bang. It's a bunch of big hooey. Yeah, I mean, I've heard those debates, right? So I'm not saying it's a straw man. Like, I have heard people argue that. But I'm saying actually in this field of the standard ID camp, they cite the Big Bang as evidence in favor of the existence of a God, of a creator God, because the scientific consensus was not always in favor. In other words, the idea that the universe had an origin in terms of science is relatively recent. It was only in the 20th century that that became the consensus view among scientists. Before then, scientists thought that the universe was static. I think they either thought it was finite and static, or I think they actually thought it was infinite. And so in that sense, you know, it was static. And then there were some issues like, well, gee, if the universe is infinite, like when we look up at the night sky, shouldn't it just be like a sheet of white? And there, you know, there were some issues there about that kind of stuff. And then, but for example, most famously, if you just go look it up, it's Einstein's cosmological constant. Go check that out, what that is. And this is the most famous blunder that Einstein made when he was setting up his equations for general relativity, right? So special relativity had to do with constant velocity and like if things are near the speed of light, what happens to space and time and that kind of stuff. But not talking about acceleration. And then general relativity had to do with accelerating objects and gravity. And then the idea that, oh, instead of viewing gravity as a force the way Newton did, maybe we view it as a curvature of space-time and all that kind of stuff. And one of the things that popped out of Einstein's early formulation was that the universe wouldn't be static. It would be, I think I'm getting this right, either expanding or contracting, like, you know, moving outward because the expansion, the momentum of it was more than the, you know, the gravitational attraction could overcome. And so it would just be constantly expanding. Or, you know, depending on the specifics, it should be collapsing in on itself. But the point was, just with a standard, you know, first pass in his equations, he couldn't, there was nothing that was going to keep a finite universe just still. Like there, it wouldn't be stable. There wouldn't be an equilibrium given his equation. And Einstein, that bothered Einstein. So he just arbitrarily invented a new term into the equations to balance out the gravitational force. Like to be pushing the galaxies away from each other to counteract the tendency of gravity to pull them all in towards, you know, the center, and that's the way you would achieve equilibrium. And he called that the cosmological constant. And then later, you know, it's like with Hubble and such, you know, making observations, and the further away galaxies were, the more redshift of the light was, and they just realized more and more, like, no, it looks like the universe is expanding, and it's consistent with the fact that if you turn the clock backwards at all, started at a single point and then exploded outward. And apparently Einstein said like that was the greatest blunder of his career or something like that, right? In other words, besides everything else he had done, he could have come up with an elegant mathematical formulation of what would later turn out to be, you know, considered a better model of the universe at large, cosmology is that field. But he panicked, he chickened out because he just couldn't believe the implications of that. And so he didn't go with it. He just kind of arbitrarily, all right. Incidentally, now with more observations and stuff, they've reintroduced that. And it has to do with the, I get mixed up. I can't remember if it's dark matter or dark energy. I think it's dark energy. But so anyway, this is kind of ironic, the twists and turns. But be that as it may, the standard story, and I think Einstein admitted it as such, was that he just his gut told him, no, this can't be right, and he introduced something there. Okay, so what's the point of me going off on that tangent, which hopefully is at least 90% accurate, the spirit of it is for sure, is that even in the early 20th century, even somebody like Einstein did not think the universe was expanding. And he didn't, you know, therefore think that, oh, the universe started at some finite point in the past and then exploded outward. That, no, that was a theory that did not gain currency until more evidence piled up during the course of the 20th century. Okay? And so if you have this notion in your head that, oh, yeah, scientists have always believed the universe had this started at some point and then whatever, that's these creation. In other words, it's not that the creation, the biblical creationists and the atheist scientists agreed that the universe always had an origin, and just they disagreed on the details and that the age, like how long ago in the past did it start? That's not the case. That, no, there was a long philosophical and even scientific tradition thinking the universe has always existed, and it was the people who believed in the Judeo-Christian God and, you know, the Genesis account that thought it had a finite past. I'm not saying they're the only one. Like, maybe other religions did too. I don't know. But I'm just saying it wasn't like everybody thought that, okay? So there's another way of showing that it is not the case that the modern ID movement is simply a smokescreen or a Trojan horse for old school biblical creationism, according to the Genesis account. Okay, so let's just dive into it more here. So Michael Behe, he has a PhD in biochemistry from the University of Pennsylvania, for what that's worth. And his big contribution to this is the notion of what's called irreducible complexity. And so he's saying, according to the standard Darwinian account, the way an organism goes from an earlier state and then, you know, evolves and eventually turns into something more complicated, the story is that, oh, there's just random mutations that most of the time do not confer an advantage in terms of natural selection. But once in a great while, there actually is an advantageous mutation. And then because of that, that particular organism now is able to make more copies of itself that end up surviving and making copies of themselves and so on. And so that trait gets selected for, that mutation. And then that just keeps happening. And you let the clock run for billions of years. And over time, there's, you know, various lines and just all kinds of mutations that are advantageous accumulate in a sense. And that's how now, looking around, we see all the different species out there and all the different types of life forms. And so Behe is saying, if you go and look at a particular structure, a biological structure, and it is such that its complexity means if you removed any one element of it, the thing would be greatly hampered, then it's hard to see how the whole system or complex structure could have emerged in this incremental fashion, right? So if it's something like you look at a giraffe's neck and you say, geez, why is that so long? It makes sense to say, oh, well, you know, maybe if you went back far enough, you'd see giraffes, but they would have necks that look like horses. But then, you know, they're all competing for the leaves on the trees or something. And then the one, there's a mutation and one's neck gets to be a little bit longer. And then that thing can reach the leaves that the other giraffes can't because they have shorter necks. And so then that guy has more offspring. And then, you know, it just keeps continuing. And so that's why you let that go for a few million years and boom, now there's all these giraffes walking around with really tall necks. Right? Yeah, that makes sense. But if you want to say something really complicated like an eye, to take a standard example, like the giraffe's eye, how do you explain that thing? And there, it's not as obvious to say, oh, well, you know, originally they were blind. They didn't have anything there. And then you can see why it would have met, you know, they would have gotten
the nerves that transmit the visual information to the brain would have arisen, you know, just randomly through mutation. And then you get, you know, a cornea would have made sense to just random, or not really a cornea, but like 1% of a cornea could have been a random mutation. And then the 2% and the 3% and da, 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 da. Do you see how that's not working? That it to have 2% of an eye does not give you an advantage. All right, because it's not even like your vision is 2% better than nothing. Or, well, that's infinite, but you get what I'm saying. It's not that your vision is 2% of what it could be with a fully functional eye. No, your vision is zero if all you have is a cornea and you don't have the other components. Okay, so that's the idea. All right, I'm going to go through this stuff fast because I have a ton of material to get through. All right, so I'm not going to get hung up on every objection or anything. Believe me, you know, he's literally written books on this stuff. I think I saw Michael Behe at a conference at Hillsdale when I was a professor there, and I saw the critics. You know, they had a legit exchange of ideas, and then, you know, they had PhD biologists getting up there and saying why they thought he was wrong. So I understand both sides. I'm not going to debate it here. I'm just telling you what the position is, what the claim is. All right, and so the idea is that standard Darwinian mechanisms cannot explain how these complex structures came to be. And he says, you know, one of his points too is that things got a lot harder. So this is another misconception. Sometimes people castigate the ID people as like a god of the gaps. And they say, oh yeah, at any given time, you know, mainstream science has not pushed back the boundaries of our ignorance fully. And so at any given time, there's still gaps in our knowledge. There's still things we can't explain yet. We keep explaining more and more. We're always getting better. We understand the natural world more and more with each passing year. But yeah, at any given time, there's stuff we don't know. And that's where the theists go. And they just go to the stuff that we can't explain yet and say, oh yeah, see, so this is what God did. And so the zone of where God is cited, because we still, you know, our ignorance has not yet been completely evaporated, is where God hangs out. And that there's, you know, the territory claimed by the church just keeps shrinking. So that's a standard view. And I'm saying, no, that's not correct. That, and this is one of Behe's points, that when Darwin wrote, the scientists of the day, they really didn't understand much about the cell. They just kind of thought the cell was this pretty simple thing that was just a blob of stuff. And they knew that, oh yeah, the cells come together and form very complex, you know, tissues and organs and systems and organisms and stuff. But they thought the basic constituents of life, you know, the cell were pretty straightforward. Just like, you know, if you push it down, atoms are fairly straightforward as far as we know, right? They're pretty simple building blocks. There's not too much going on to, you know, to characterize a hydrogen atom. It's not too complicated, all right? But he said what they found is they got electron microscopes and, you know, really could start looking at these things in the 20th century. Is that no, even ostensibly very simple cells are incredibly complex machines. And so his famous thing is called the bacterial flagellum. And he, you know, he gives, you know, in his book, he goes through that stuff. And if he has presentations, they got cool videos they've made. I'll link to it. So bobmurphyshow.com/319. I'll put an example of a video up where you can look at this thing. And I mean, if you had no context and you didn't know how complicated organisms were, like even fairly simple small organisms that you know microscope to really look at, and I showed you one of these things, I said, oh, this is clearly, you know, a nanobot that the Chinese invented, because look at this, you might believe me, because it looks like an outboard motor. The flagellum's a thing that it's like a tail. And it helps it navigate in liquids. All right. And again, I'm not going to try to reproduce the stuff here because I'm going to botch the details, but I'll give you a link to a video if you've never seen it. It's amazing just how much this particular bacterium can zoom around inside of a liquid with this thing. And again, if you didn't have any context, you would say that is a machine. That thing was, it looks like a little submarine that was designed in order to navigate in this environment. Okay, and so, you know, he's going through and saying it's not a matter of just there's a few simple parts here. You can see how over time random mutations would have allowed for this piece to then, quote, you know, oh yeah, and then if it gained this piece, then it would be a little bit, have a more reproductive fitness, and that's why it would make more copies of itself, and over time the population would all have that trait. Oh, and then this would get added to it, and that would make it a little better. That no, there's like 19 different moving parts, literally, that all have to come together, and if you took any one of them away, the thing wouldn't work, and it would just have this useless engine that it was just carrying around doing nothing. And so why would that develop? That would not be construed as an advantageous mutation at steps 1 through 18. Okay, so that's kind of the idea. And so it's not clear how you would tell an evolutionary story that simply relies on random mutation acted upon by natural selection to generate this thing if you started out from something much simpler. That's the idea.
Hey folks, let's take a break from the action to talk about our sponsor for today, Monetary Metals. Now we all know the dollar's losing value because of inflation. And we all know that owning gold protects your wealth from eroding away. But one of the biggest objections to owning gold is that it just sits there. There's no yield. It doesn't pay you any interest or dividends. In fact, you have to pay fees to store and insure it. But what if you could actually earn interest on gold? Well, that's exactly what Monetary Metals offers. With Monetary Metals, you can earn between 2% to 5% on your gold and silver every year. And if you're an accredited investor, you're eligible to earn even higher yields. But how does it work? How are they able to pay interest on gold? And let me say, folks, this part of their business model, it took me a bit to understand. After all, I thought, it's not like physical gold bars turn into more gold bars a year later. So how could they reliably promise you a return denominated in physical gold? Well, here's how it works. Monetary Metals connects you and your ounces with companies that need physical gold inventory for their business, such as jewelers, mints, refineries, bullion dealers, and more. The businesses need gold, and Monetary Metals lets you rent your gold to these qualified businesses. Now, in a more conventional arrangement, a jeweler, for example, might buy raw gold at its market price, fashion it into necklaces, rings, and so on, and then down the road sell the finished products. But this more conventional model involves risk for the jeweler, because the price of gold can drop in the interim, meaning they won't be able to sell the necklaces, rings, and so on for what they originally forecasted. If they had relied on a loan, quoted in dollars, to finance their initial purchase of the raw gold, they might be unable to pay back their creditors. But with Monetary Metals on the scene, there's another option. Now these businesses get the gold they need to use in their own business without being exposed to gold price risk. The jeweler, for example, borrows the raw gold at the start and promises a markup in physical gold. Then, no matter what happens to the spot price of gold, the jeweler's built-in margin from transforming raw gold into earrings, rings, and so on kicks in and allows him to pay back his loan after the final sale. The jeweler benefits, and you get to put your gold to work for a regularly monthly income in gold. It's a win-win. Now, when I say interest on gold, paid in gold, I mean it. It's actually paid in ounces of gold. For example, let's say you start out with 100 ounces and the interest rate is 3% annual. That means you will be earning 3 additional ounces of gold every year, regardless of what the spot price of gold does during the year. You just watch your total gold ounces grow every month and leverage the power of compound interest, but measured in ounces of physical gold and silver. So let's recap. Why would you earn interest in dollars, which are constantly losing value, when you can earn interest in gold? Go to www.monetary-metals.com/Murphy to learn more or to get started opening an account. In case you're wondering, I've opened an account with them myself, and my gold is now growing more gold at Monetary Metals. So again, go to monetary-metals.com/Murphy to get started growing your gold too. Okay, let's get back to the show.
Now, again, just to be clear, it's not therefore that Behe is saying, so on the fourth day, God created the bacterial flagellum. That's not what he's saying. He's okay
with the idea that if we somehow had, you know, a camera up in a satellite around the Earth that was around for billions of years and just occasionally took snapshots of the biosphere, that you might see, oh, boom, at this point, the first cell emerged somehow. And then it made copies of itself and then did it over time. But I think what Behe's point is, there must have been a lot of information somehow either packed into that cell or somehow embedded in the environment that you can't just say, oh, that's just random, whatever, and that it's not an awe-inspiring cosmic coincidence that the conditions were such that all this varied life popped out. All right, and so let me do a little thought experiment here to help motivate this stuff, and it also pave the way for some of the other discussion. I was thinking through this, and you know, I don't know if it's going to help you any, but imagine humans locate, you know, we get better technology, maybe colonize the moon, and we put up a lot of telescopes and things there, other kind of sensing equipment without the atmosphere, you know, especially when it's the night on the moon, like it's, you know, really crystal clear and we can really see far out. And maybe we identify a bunch of systems that aren't too far away that have a bunch of planets that could support human life, but they need some work, right? That they're, you know, like the fundamentals are strong, but yeah, there's like this one planet just got to, I don't even know enough about chemistry to even make something up. I want to say like, oh, it's full of methane and we got to convert it into oxygen, CO2. I don't even know if that makes sense, but you get the idea. All right. So imagine we find candidate planets like that, and then we're going to send some colonists, you know, we're going to put them in stasis or whatever, because it's, the trip's going to take hundreds of years to get out there. And so maybe we got to put them in a deep freeze or something like that, even if the ship gets close to the speed of light, so they're not aging that much still. Just the acceleration, the deceleration takes a long time. You don't want them to be sitting up there looking outside of a ship at space for 30 years from their point of view. But we, before we send the people, we have to send like a scout ship that goes and terraforms the planet. You know, so it lands and it releases stuff onto this planet, and it would like cells that just start making copies. Maybe like maybe the planet's just a bunch of mostly ocean or something, and so then they go in there, but there's no life originally, and then they just start copying themselves, and they slowly start changing the composition of the atmosphere. Like, you know, these things, they take the atmosphere as it is, and then their waste products and whatever they, whether they're doing respiration or whatever, and it over time transforms the atmosphere into something that's closer to Earth's atmosphere, right? And then also it starts populating the oceans with plankton or whatever. And then, so if you just think it through, like to try to get the stage, the thing, and get it ready so that when the humans land, you know, not necessarily there's going to be a bunch of zebras running around, but that there'll be trees and grass and maybe some bees or whatever. And then some, or at least the land will be suitable so when the humans get there, they can take a bunch of seeds that they brought with them and start planting apple trees and corn and whatever. Okay. So I'm just saying, if the planet originally was pretty far from what Earth is like, but it was, you know, the amount of sunlight it got in its system and, you know, that kind of stuff was okay, something we could work with. Again, you can imagine the humans, depending on how advanced you were, sending a capsule ahead of time that was going to have 50 years to get the planet ready before the humans showed up. So if you just think through how complicated that would be, because you'd have to do it in stages, right? Like, if the atmosphere is not right, the first thing you'd have to do was have a bunch of cells that multiply, that then, because of their standard respiration or whatever, they take the original atmosphere and turn it into what we want. But then presumably if that happened, then those things would die off. Right. And so in other words, like when the humans land, if they want to see a bunch of grass and palm trees or something, those things could not have been the first. It's not like when the capsule first lands is going to distribute a bunch of seeds from apple trees, because the atmosphere wouldn't support them at that point, right? It would have to be a multi-stage transformative process where first one thing happened and then that allowed for the next thing to happen, right? And so if you think it through, you could imagine, oh, well, then maybe the capsule the humans send, or maybe they send like 10 different capsules 5 years apart or something. And so the first capsule lands and it's got 5 years to do what it wants to. You could imagine that, or you could just imagine the first thing has it all. But I was thinking it through, and you know, you wouldn't want to take the chance that the first vial opens and then it, you know, it makes the atmosphere right, but then the second vial that was supposed to release the grasses, something happened to it. And now I would think you'd want all that information packed into the cells from the get-go. And you would be able to do that. That's part of the point here, is that it's not hard to fit a bunch of information into even, you know, simple cells, that most of which you don't need to use right away. And that just over time, various portions of that genetic code get activated. All right. And so that the point being, because once the thing lands and starts, they start reproducing, if you have the entire code of what you need to be done to transform the planet packed into each one, and this, so that a whole copy of the whole code is being made each time. So after 24 hours, maybe there's 10,000 copies. And then, you know what I mean? So like if something happens, because it can be kind of hard, the thing's 300 light years away, there's all kinds of stuff that could go wrong. And so you want there to be a pretty robust plan. And it's like, again, it's not that, oh, you just want one capsule hanging out where it landed for 5 years before it opens up, because something could happen to it. You know, a comet could hit it or something. Or there could be an earthquake. A boulder could fall on it, or who knows what. So that's why I think it would make more sense that right away, as soon as that thing lands and starts and releases phase one, it's already making hundreds of millions of copies of itself. So that just as long as one of those cells lasts to phase two, then whatever the environmental triggers are that unleashes the activation of phase two, and then the cell mutates and starts making all kinds of copies of something that now thrives in this new environment that phase one helped usher in, and so on. Okay. So if you can imagine, you know, if you just even get what I'm saying, whether or not you think it makes sense, but, or whether or not you think, oh yes, you just described the optimal plan, Bob, but I'm saying, I hope you get where I'm coming from when I'm musing along those lines. So I'm saying, I think Behe believes something like that is what happened on Earth. That, oh, it seemed like there was a heck of a lot of information packed into even the early cells that had no business being there. There was no reason for it to be there if the evolutionary process is in fact just completely blind and unguided due to mutation and natural selection, that really has no purpose, that there's no teleology involved. And that even though we talk with that language sometimes, that's just metaphorical. And strictly speaking, you know, it's not that we're more evolved now than the creatures were 200 million years ago. There's no point to evolution. Okay, so that's, I think, where he's coming from. And also, just to anticipate one of the objections, or to talk about, I'm going to just deal with it right now. A lot of times people will say, it's not just that ID is wrong, it's that it's unscientific. It's not even a scientific explanation to invoke design. Okay, so what if the story I just told is actually what happens? Okay, that could happen, right? It's not logically impossible the way I just said could happen. So that it could be the case that 600 years from now, there could be humans, and maybe they've been genetically altered, and you know their bodies are modified with computer chip implants and whatever, so that, you know, from our perspective now, we might not even recognize them as humans, but you know, they would be our descendants.
And they could be on this planet that's in a system 600 light years away, and maybe something happened with their records or whatever, and they forgot. They just did not remember where they came from. And so they're kind of looking around with fresh eyes at their environment and trying to figure out, you know, their planet's teeming with life. It's got nice lush grass and trees and bees flying around pollinating things, and everything else seems to be coordinated. Oh, isn't it amazing? And they're all just like, nope, there's no designer at work here. This is all just, it must have just been, there was this primordial soup and a bolt of lightning hit the pond a long time ago, and somehow amino acids were involved and these proteins formed and folded on themselves in this complicated pattern that was one in a quadrillion chance, but it happened. And then the first cell got formed and it had DNA strands and and they're going through all that. And you're saying, even though they're spouting nonsense, that their scientists are bumbling around and they're just making up stuff that did not happen. And are you saying that if somebody tried to use evidence and reasoning and like to test those various hypotheses to say, is that really an adequate explanation? Does that fit the data we're seeing? That would be unscientific, and that at best, the only way they could ever come upon, the only people in their society who would even have the permission or authority to ask the question, well, gee, maybe there was another intelligent species that evolved on a different planet from ours, and they seeded this planet a long time ago with this, like these supercells that had all the information packed into them. You're saying if some chemist or biologist said, you know, that actually might fit the data better, let's at least keep that open as a possibility, that they should be drummed out of their schools because that's not even a valid scientific question? Is that really your position? So to be clear, I'm not saying that's what happened on Earth. But I'm saying if somebody says, hey, it doesn't look like the standard Darwinian account fits here, it just doesn't work. Like, you can say some words and tell a story, but when you actually try to rigorously do it, it does not work. You cannot explain, or to put it a different way, there's not enough time that you might need 100 billion years in order to see for the Darwinian process to produce the stuff we're seeing. You just don't have enough time, given what we think the age of the universe is and the age of Earth. And so if you want to say, no, you're wrong, because maybe we can, okay. But to say that's not even a scientific position, that's just crazy. You're just trying to load the deck from the outset. And I would say what you're saying is itself unscientific. Okay. Incidentally, I will also listen, I kind of alluded there to the origin of life, talking about the proteins and stuff. That's another area, right? So a lot of times these debates just walk backwards toward, you know, the first cell, and that's the starting point, and then we're arguing over common descent and what could explain that. But, you know, it goes further than that too, right? Where did that first cell come from? And there too, it's, I think if you went and surveyed some of the people working on that question in the 1950s and said, how much progress do you think will be made by the year 2024? They would have thought a lot more progress would be made than has been made. All right, so again, go to bobmurphyshow.com/319. I will link to, there's a good discussion I can give you from two people who are very qualified to talk about this stuff. And, you know, I can't even pretend to reproduce some of their arguments, but you'll just have to go listen to those guys and tell me if you think they're charlatans or if you think, no, these guys sound like they know what they're talking about. And yet, in the origin of life research, there has not been much progress made at all in the last 60 years. Okay. William Dembski. So this guy likes going to school. He's got a PhD in math from the University of Chicago. He's got a PhD in philosophy from the University of Illinois at Chicago. And then he's also got a Master's of Divinity in theology from Princeton. All right. So these are not shabby institutions. These are
PhD in math and philosophy. That's not shabby. And I don't know what Master of Divinity in Theology. I don't know how hard that is, but to get that at Princeton is not something to sneeze at. So you listen to this guy talk, you read some of his stuff. He's not a dumb guy, all right? And so his big contribution to this is what's called specified complexity. And maybe one way of describing what he does is he takes results from information theory and computer science and applies them to the biological field or realm. And so here he actually now, the name's escaping me, but one of his big books in this field, I think maybe the design inference, but I might be getting mixed up. He had a new edition come out, and now the co-author on that was Winston Ewart, who's been twice a guest on the Bob Murphy Show. All right. In Winston's background, I think he's got a PhD in, I don't know if it's called computer science, but that's what Winston's specialty is computer science. All right. And so he kind of helped Dembski formalize some of his conjectures from his earlier work. And so a bunch of stuff, they like literally prove it, make it more rigorous. Okay. So the stuff with specified complexity, what Dembski's trying to do is he's going to talk about the design inference. And he wants to say, first of all, in many areas of human inquiry, we use the design inference, that when we see something, we encounter something, whether it's the motion of cells, we see a person moving around doing something, and we sit, this is kind of like overlaps with praxeology, human action, that if someone's falling out of an airplane, you might wonder what happened originally, like did someone push him or did he jump? But once the guy's fallen, there's not too much, especially if he doesn't have a parachute or anything there. It's kind of like the physicist takes over. It just explains, oh, yeah, he's a lump of cells and he's got this kind of surface area and here's what's going on. Maybe if the guy changes his position, he can change the drag from the atmosphere on him or whatever. But that's one thing. Whereas you see people driving in traffic, how do you explain that? You don't just rely on physics. No, because the choices of the drivers has a lot to do with that pattern or have. Okay. And so that's one obvious example in terms of the design inference, where if you see things that you assume, oh no, there's an intelligence behind it, but there's plenty of other areas. Okay. So let me just go through some of these, like, skywriting. Right. If you look up in the sky and you see what appears to be clouds, but then it says 50% off at Jim's hardware store, act now. You're not thinking, wow, what are the chances that the clouds for? No, there must have been a plane that went up there and did something. And that's a commercial and some human designed that pattern. In the movie Contact, right, the 1997 movie with Jodie Foster, what's the plot there? Well, she's a SETI, which is Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence researcher, and they get, there's like some pulses coming in from a distant quasar or something, and they notice, it's very regular, right? So it doesn't seem like anything big deal, but then they notice that, no, it's listing the prime numbers. Right, that like the pattern, it's going through. I forget how but it's not just like a whoom, 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 but no, it's going through the prime numbers, and that's not a natural occurrence, right? And so then they realize there's an intelligence here, and they investigate further, and they realize it's aliens communicating with us, all right? So, there was a famous case recently, a few years ago, where some guy was accused of some chess. I don't know if he was a grandmaster, but a guy who was good at chess. I think he beat Magnus Carlsen in one match or something, and it was an upset. And then later he was barred from entering some other tournament because they had looked at a bunch of his online games and accused him of cheating. And by the way, I don't think they commented on the game he played against Magnus Carlsen, but I think it was for other reasons, and they didn't have jurisdiction over that particular game anyway. But so there, right? Like, how would you even go about that? What would it mean to look at the history of some guy's chess matches, and accuse him? So cheating in this context means he relies on an engine, right? Because now, in case you don't know, computers are way better than the best humans at chess. And so if somebody's playing, like at any given state of the board, the computer engine can tell you what the, quote, optimal move is. And at least, you know, in terms of the state of the art, like, I think they do occasionally make engines that are better than the previous version. And so maybe this is, by the way, something I would like to go investigate. Like to see, do the new engines, is it just that they're better playing each other, or even do they give different opinions as to past classic games where the old engines thought this was the optimal move, and now does the new engine say, no, actually, this would be, I don't know enough about it. That's something, if I get more free time, I want to look into. But in any event, the engines right now crush the best humans. And so in a given situation, if you were able to just plug that into your engine and say, what would you do here? It's going to give you a move that's better than what the human's going to do. And that's actually how they evaluate games ex post, is to say, like, for each move, did the human player, how far were they from what the right thing was? You know, and the engine can kind of evaluate and, like, say, oh, yeah, that wasn't the best move, but it wasn't too bad. Or like, whoa, that was a blunder. What'd you do that for? That was stupid. Okay. So how would you go about doing that? Well, it's not enough to just say on the opening move, did you make a move that the engine would have also made? Because it's, you know, that's not surprising. Like, humans have memorized openings and stuff, you know what I mean? So that doesn't mean you cheated. And also, too, like near the end game, when there's not very many pieces left and it's pretty obvious how it's going to play out, if you, quote, played perfect chess from, you know, like your last seven moves, that doesn't prove you were cheating, even if your moves were indistinguishable from what the chess engine would have done, because, you know, it might be pretty obvious at that point, if you're really good at chess, what the right thing to do would be. But where it's, you know, more obvious, or there's more of a question, is like in the mid game, when there's still a lot of possibilities, and particularly if you make a move that looks like it's a bad move, but actually is a really brilliant move. You know, that might be an example. And especially if, based on your previous games, you don't usually make moves like that, right? And so there could be situations. So here I'm kind of just, you know, I'm not being completely crisp about it, but I'm just trying to motivate to get you to see, surely it makes sense to say, given enough time and if the stakes are high enough and we had a bunch of people looking at it, does it even make sense to say, do we think this guy's could have been cheating? Right? That certainly would not be unscientific to ask that question. Right? And so there's a way we could look and try to distinguish. Okay, so here, in fairness, I'm not distinguishing between like spontaneous versus designed. It's a different kind of comedy, but the idea being that you're trying to see how much of, like, intelligence, I guess, could be involved. All right, another example, plagiarism, right? Someone gets accused of plagiarism. So here, the specific thing is, you wrote text that's awfully similar to some previously published work. And then, so then the question is, you know, how are we going to accuse you of copying it. And so you see how this kind of gets close to, so this overlaps. Again, I'll circle back to what Dembski's deal is, but I'm just trying to motivate this with examples. But he's saying, you know, if the fact that you used the phrase, I don't know, the weather was hot or something, like if you use that phrase and then some novelist also used that phrase, that doesn't mean you copied from the novelist and therefore you're a plagiarist, right? You could have independently stumbled upon that same word choice, right? But if you write in your book, to be or not to be, that is the question. I think that's the quote, right? Then for sure, you didn't just independently make that up. That's too improbable. Okay, so that's the kind of stuff that Dembski gets at. So he calls it specified complexity, where when you're trying to detect design, to distinguish it from just randomness, or in some of these other examples I'm giving you here, independent discovery. It's like something's got to be improbable, but also it has to correspond to a pre-existing pattern. Okay, so different kind of example. How would you know that somebody's license plate is a vanity plate, right? Meaning like they went to the DMV and they paid extra money so that their license plate could say what they wanted rather than just being randomly assigned something. Okay, so you might think at first it would have to do with the improbability, right? Like, so I'm driving and I see someone's license plate that says, you know, Ron Paul 08 or something. Okay. Clearly that's not random. That was designed. If I'm driving around and the car ahead of me, his license plate says Ron Paul 08. I know that driver likes Ron Paul and that he purposely, and notice I said he, that's a good inference, designed the license plate to say that, right? Now notice, it's interesting. If somebody said, well, why? Strictly speaking, it's not the full explanation to just say, because that's improbable that could have arisen from chance. That's a true statement, but that doesn't seal the deal. Because any particular license plate you see, wow, the chance of seeing X7349 alpha beta, or you get what I'm saying, is also one in a blah, 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 right? If you take dice and roll them 10 times in a row, whatever outcome you get is going to be very improbable. All right, but if you get snake eyes 10 times in a row, you're not going to think that that's a fair set of dice, even though the chance of getting snake eyes 10 times in a row is just as likely as getting a particular other sequence, you know, with the 10 rolls, meaning the exact ways that the die come up. I'm not saying like what they add up to. Okay, if you get the point I'm making. So Dembski is saying it's not merely the improbability of an outcome, it's that it has to correspond to some pre-existing pattern. Okay, a different example. When we look at Mount Rushmore, we know that was designed. I'm not going to sit there and say, whoa, I mean, maybe the erosion and the hail could have done this, or maybe there was a river a long time ago that was going over and it could have did it. No, you look at that and you know that has to be designed. How? Again, it's not merely because any particular contour of the mountainside would be improbable. It's that it's improbable, but also it corresponds to a pattern that we independently know before we looked at that thing. Okay, so that's kind of where he's coming from with the specified complexity. To give another couple of examples, the field of data falsification, right? So if you think that a certain scientist maybe was faking the data, you know, he's sending in and getting papers published talking about, oh, yes, and then I took the 10 vials and I applied the treatment to 5 of them and I did the control with the other 5 and then I, you know, blah, blah, blah. And what if you suspect he's just making up stuff that makes his theory look good? So again, you can do certain statistical tests to see. And then another really good example for our topic here is to see if like a virus or something was engineered in the lab, right? Like that was one of the things with COVID-19. Some people were saying, oh, it was made in a Chinese lab. And so whether you think it was or not, the point is that's not an unscientific question to say, is there evidence of design in this particular virus? Now, I know because I've seen it happen on this. People will flip out. Like, no, because we understand that humans exist and we understand what they're capable of. And so we can see telltale signs. But to say, did God make the bacterial flagellum? That's just stupid. And we don't know. I understand they're not literally the same thing. But again, strictly speaking, the ID theorists are not saying we're going to go test the hypothesis that God made the bacterial flagellum. That's not what they're saying. Instead, what they're doing is Dembski is trying to look at all these different examples where we use rigorous analysis to try to distinguish the results of a blind, mindless process versus deliberate, intentional design from a mind that, you know, we'll leave unspecified for the moment, and then see which hypothesis makes more sense. So what he ends up saying is you can't, it's not so much that you would ever be able to rule out design, right? Because a designer could try to camouflage his tracks or its tracks, if you want to, you know, if it's some alien that we don't think assigning a sex to or gender to makes sense. But, all right, so the fact that you don't see evidence of design doesn't mean, therefore, there isn't a designer. But the point is, when you see telltale evidence of a design, then that kind of rules out the possibility that there isn't a designer. All right. So same thing with the bioweapon, that it does make sense. It's perfectly reasonable to look at an organism like a virus or something and to say, could this have arisen given what we know from a blind Darwinian process, or does it look like there was deliberate design involved? Okay, so if you can do it in that setting, then it's not unscientific to step back and to broaden it and just say, in general, for any organism, could it have arisen in the step-by-step incremental fashion posited by orthodox Darwinian theory? Another example that they raise in this field is to say you're an archaeologist and you come across this rock and you're looking at it and it's kind of triangular. And to be able to look at that and say, is this just a rock or is this actually an arrowhead that the people who lived in this region must have fashioned, whatever, 1,200 years ago, and we just found it. Right? So there's a way you can inspect this physical thing. I mean, it is a rock, but the question is it merely a rock or has this thing been acted upon by a designer? And again, there's, you might just think it through and maybe even talk to some archaeologists and whatever to ask them exactly how would you do it. But certainly you can imagine the broad outlines of what that would look like. And for one thing is, if it looked like it was extremely suitable to being an arrowhead, and it would be unlikely that normal processes of erosion and blah, blah, blah would have produced it to be in that configuration, then you could say, yes, our best hypothesis here is that this was deliberately designed to be like this. Okay, so again, Dembski, you know, sort of gives a lot of these stylized examples saying we use the design inference all the time. It's not unscientific in all these other areas. And then he tries to codify or formalize what is it that we're doing? What's the common element through all this stuff? And again, it has to do with his idea of specified complexity. And then with his work with Winston Ewart, he's gotten more rigorous over time with actually nailing it down. And there's some loose ends. And I guess in his earlier work, he, you know, went down some cul-de-sacs and realized later, like, no, actually, we don't even need to worry about that. We can just fold that stuff into this, you know, other principle, blah, blah, blah. So it's more streamlined now. But the point being to try to formalize what does it mean when we use the design inference in these other areas where it's completely uncontroversial. And then let's take that framework now and apply it to biology. And if you do that, his claim is, then boom, it looks like there's design all over the place. One other example that I thought was interesting was there's this novel called Gadsby that came out. I pulled up its Wikipedia entry. Come on, here we go. I guess it came out in 1939. And so it's a 50,000-word novel, and it does not use the letter E, or it purports not to. That apparently the Wikipedia entry is saying actually the guy screwed up, that there were three times in the book he uses the word the, and then once he says officers, right? So whether, you know, he did that and hoped no one would notice, or he just legitimately missed it. But other than that, apparently no one has discovered, I don't know if they scanned the thing in and looked for it with brute force, but apparently, all right, so I'll read it to you. Not the 53,000 word novel. Here's the opening paragraph of this book. If youth throughout all history had had a champion to stand up for it, to show a doubting world that a child can think and possibly do it practically, you wouldn't constantly run across folks today who claim that a child don't know anything. A child's brain starts functioning at birth and has, amongst its many infant convolutions, thousands of dormant atoms into which God has put a mystic possibility for noticing an adult's act and figuring out its purport. Okay, so there, if I didn't prime you and I read that, that might not jump out at you as being anything weird. It was a little bit archaic, or something was a little bit odd to it, but that wouldn't have jumped out at you. But the point is, you go through a 50,000-word novel, and by the end of it, and someone says, you know, in this book, the letter E was never used. And let's say you missed the four times it was. And then you say, what? And in case you don't know, E is the most common letter in English, in terms of, you know, written English text. That's why, like, with the Wheel of Fortune, you're going to buy a vowel, you buy E. All right, so the point being, could you possibly imagine if someone, you know, gives you this manuscript and you read it and then you just happen to notice that and you go test it and say, oh yeah, there's no E in here. Was that an accident, right? Is it possible the author wasn't intending to do that? And the answer is clearly no, that's impossible. Clearly the guy who wrote this set out to not include an E. And you can see some of the tell, like, for example, when it says run across folks today who claim that a child don't know anything. So there it's, you know, it might be more naturally a child doesn't know anything, but doesn't would have an E. And for sure at the end there, when it say into which God has put a mystic possibility for noticing an adult's act and figuring out its purport, right? You would, the more natural word there would have been it figuring out its purpose, but purpose has an E, so he couldn't use it. Okay. So that's why it sounds kind of funny, is because there were certain places where the guy, you know, he couldn't come up with a natural way to say it, and so it ends up just sounding stilted. All right. But like I say, any one sentence, if there's no E, might not jump out at you. But to go pages and pages and pages without using an E, that's clearly not a coincidence. He set out to do that. Okay, so again, if you just think through why is that, like why are we so sure? You know, it has to do with the improbability of it, right? So it's kind of interesting. It's almost the other way around that, like there's something missing, right? If you get what I'm saying. So that's why I like that example that they brought that up on one of the
ID podcast that I think Dembski was involved in. But anyway, I thought that one was neat just to show you. So again, I'm just here trying to get you to see in all these different examples of how you're trying to like determine was something on purpose or a coincidence or just due to blind chance, and how what our intuitions are in these various other examples. And so if you go ahead and try to nail down more concretely, what is it that we're doing in all these different examples? And then you say, all right, so what would that mean then in the biological realm? And Dembski's claim is, if you do that, you're going to see design jumps out. Okay, let me go through this part real fast. One of the things that Dembski does that I liked early on when I was hip deep into this stuff is he's got a math PhD, and he went and he took these things called, they're called NFL theorems or no free lunch. So he didn't do the theorems. These other guys did. I think it was plural. Maybe it wasn't. I'm going to say it in spirit. The idea is if you have a search algorithm, in general, unless you know something about the terrain over which you're searching or the space through which you're searching, then if you try to optimize by like using an algorithm to first pick the search algorithm before you then actually go do the search, that's not going to improve upon just blind searching. All right. So maybe where he's going, the reason he's going into this stuff is because part of what happens is in the standard arguments over Darwinism, the cynics who think, no, modern life forms are way too complex. Did you like go look at the structure of DNA and all these proteins and all folded around in a certain way? There's no way. The chance of that happening is one in a quadrillion, quadrillion, quadrillion. There's not even, it's more than the atoms in the universe kind of deal. And so then the proponents of the standard Darwinian story will say, but it's not mere chance, right? Yeah. So that if you looked at the space of all possible arrangements of amino acids or, however we're going to frame the problem, and you're right, the precise configuration in terms of the fraction of the of all possible configurations that's going to work and be able to sustain life is vanishingly small. So yes, if nature had to just blindly search through all these different possible permutations and arrangements of the inner structure of the cell, it would not randomly hit one that worked and then, oh, that's going to confer success, and now that cell's just going to start mass producing copies of itself. They agree, but they're saying it's not mere chance, right? It's aided by natural selection. Okay, so they're saying that's the algorithm that nature's using, and that's how it's, quote, discovering or stumbling upon these clever designs of body structures and whatever that work. And so what Dembski is saying is that, no, you're just displacing the problem. You're just moving it from one spot to somewhere else. And then to motivate that, to make his argument more rigorous, he was appealing to these things called these no free lunch theorems. So another way, let me try to state the theorem this way. Let's say you've got a search space and you've got a fitness function or a payoff function. You're trying to maximize it, right? So just imagine it's like an XY coordinate space, and that the Z, that's like the location. The X and Y are like the location, and then the Z axis is the height. So imagine it's like a mountain or something. There's a different terrain.
Okay, so you're picturing this 3D thing. And so suppose what you're trying to do is maximize the Z coordinate, right? You want to find the XY pair that maximizes Z. Okay, so again, if you're picturing it like being a mountain, then, you know, you want to move where in XY space is the height of that mountain, you know, the most. So you and the way, you know, sort of like Richard Dawkins, wherever, is viewing evolution is, you know, that's like a fitness landscape, and evolution just groping around trying to find, you know, not necessarily the highest point, but it's, you know, a decent point. And so the idea is that, oh, wow, over time, evolution seems to have found all of these points that are pretty high that you wouldn't have expected from just mere random chance, right? That if the x-axis has a 70 quadrillion possible, you know, possible units, and the y-axis is 70 quadrillion, well, that's a pretty big area. And so if you only had a few billion points to just scatter across that, and then X post, they were surprisingly high up. I mean, you know, let's be agnostic from a, what does that even mean? How high would you expect them to be? And then, you know, if everybody would agree that, yeah, just randomly scattering in those points and expecting them to end up pretty high up on the mountain would be kind of crazy. But then Dawkins is going to say, yeah, but it's not, you're not randomly scattering. What happens is, in the initial time period, yeah, you do some random scattering. And the next time period, maybe you just move a little bit, you know, a slight delta in the X or the Y. And you just see, did I go up or down? And if you went up, then you keep going that way. And if you're going down, then you turn back and you go the other way. Okay, so it's just, you know, little incremental improvements. And then over time, they accumulate into big movements up the mountain. And it's true, you might be stuck at a local maximum, right? That if there's various hills and whatever, you know, some organisms might get stuck at the top of a little hill, even though if they just, quote, knew enough and could see further enough away, they could have gone down the hill. And but then, you know, 70,000 years later, they could have been at the top of a nearby hill that was taller. But they don't know that, but they say, yeah, but that makes sense. You know, there's all kinds of evolutionary dead ends and things. And, you know, it's not like humans can fly or we can hold our breath for 60 hours and what, you know, so that's exactly what the way the world looks now is exactly what that process would spit out. But the fact that we're pretty well adapted and have a lot of cool features is just like everybody's kind of reached the local maximum from their original starting point, you know, of that random scattering across the landscape. Okay, so as I understand it, so what the no free lunch theorems are saying is, no, the only reason that works in that story that makes sense is because I'm assuming some properties about that landscape. I'm assuming for, you know, that story I told there, for that to make sense, we're assuming that the fitness landscape is continuous. But what if instead of it being, you know, hills and valleys and mountains and stuff like that, what if instead it's the same basic structure? Yep, there's an XY coordinate plane, and then the height of the Z coordinate for each XY pair is what we're trying to maximize. But instead of it being a nice smooth surface, what if instead it's just random, right? That there's a bunch of points for each XY pair, and the Z coordinate could be anything. And there's no reason that if you just move an infinitesimal amount in the XX, you know, the positive XX or the positive Y, that the Z change isn't very big. You know, that's what it means to say it's continuous. But what if it's not? Who said? They could be jumping all over the place and just have a bunch of points that are hovering in that volume. And so if that's what it were, and you had no information about the pattern, and there was no connection that you knew of one point in the XYZ volume compared to a nearby point, nearby meaning like not too much of a deviation in X or Y, and that you know, there wasn't some kind of rule that said, oh, given that the change in X and Y is below some certain epsilon, then the change in Z is also going to be below some other. No, there was no such principle at work. Well, then in that case, doing that particular strategy of, oh, what you do is you do a slight deviation in X and you see what happened with Z. And if Z went up, then you keep going more in that direction, right? Like you're trying to, quote, walk uphill. There's no reason that would work if there are no hills. If it's just, no, there's just a bunch of various points scattered throughout this XYZ volume. And so if your objective then is to, you know, if you got a billion different points you can throw and you can do them in burst and you can see what the results were from the previous burst before you shoot out the next burst, there's no gain, right? You can't, quote, walk up the hill the way you could in the first iteration because here we have no information. All right, so I'm being a little bit sloppy, but I'm hoping conveying the spirit of it. Okay, and so the idea is there's no, in general, if you don't know anything about the terrain, there's no way you can systematically improve on just random guessing. There's no search strategy, or in other ways, there's no way to first pick to optimize the selection strategy. Okay, so you're not helping. If you're saying, oh yeah, if you admit blind chance isn't going to work very well, there's no way you can improve upon that unless you assume you know something about the landscape already. Okay, so that's, you know, again, coming from like standard math, it has nothing to do with biology or intelligent design. So then Dembski took those results and applied it to the biology context to say, if the Darwinian biologists agree that mere blind chance would not be sufficient to explain how did these modern organisms find such a high spot in the fitness landscape, then you're not getting out of that problem by saying, oh, well, because there's natural selection too, that you're just pushing the problem to a different sector. And that in general, why would we expect, so here I'm adding more to it, why would we expect the fitness landscape to be such that, quote, blind natural or blind mutation with natural selection acting upon it would result in this complexity that we observe. Okay, so my analogy that I use to try to motivate this is to say, and sorry, if you've been listening to my stuff, you've probably heard this for fifth time now. Let's say you're in a plane, you're flying overhead, and you look down on some Pacific island, and you're shocked to see, like, you can clearly see letters, and it spells out plane crashed help. You're like, what the heck? And you go to land because you're obviously thinking there must be, or there were, people stranded there, and you're going to see if they're still around. And then you get up and you see, oh, no, this wasn't designed. And you can see that what happened was it wasn't actually letters that were arranged by some intelligence. What it was is there were tunnels or trenches in the dirt that were in the shape of letters. And then when it rained, those trenches filled up with water. And that's what you were seeing from the plane. And so, you know, given that the terrain had that shape, that structure, there, you know, it's entirely explainable in terms of just the random, you know, standard forces of nature that when it would rain, the water would roll down the hills and it would accumulate in these trenches. And that's why it would look like there were, you know, saying plane crashed help, but really that was just natural. There was no human involved. All right. So you see how there, that would be goofy. That yes, given that the dirt had those trenches arranged in just that pattern, then I don't need to invoke intelligence to explain why would water fill that up and it looks like letters. But I haven't solved the mystery. I haven't now said, oh, okay, so we don't need to look for humans. There's probably no plane crash here. Let's just move on. You know, you say, okay, the intelligence, the designer worked by digging the trenches and then let, quote, nature take its course. And that's what happened. All right. So, again, you know, that's not literally exactly what Dembski's point would mean here. But I'm saying if you try to think it through, it's, again, you're, if you're just you're saying, oh, it's natural selection. What are you talking about? Duh. That you're really skipping a lot. All right. And it's, I'm saying it's a pretty deep philosophical question such that, you know, there, my understanding is there were at least a few atheist biologists or let's say scientists. I don't know if they were all biologists who ended up believing that Earth was seeded by aliens because they came to admit or agree the standard Darwinian account doesn't work just given the constraints and how much time, you know, they would have had to work with. And so since they didn't believe in special creation a la Genesis, they thought, okay, well, it must have been Darwinian processes on some other planet where maybe they did have enough time, or maybe those creatures, if we analyze their cells, the cells will be pretty simple compared to ours. And then they sent over some super complicated cells that they designed in the lab. Who knows? All right. So that's, I'm just saying that that's a possible position one might hold. Okay, real quickly here, Stephen Meyer. He's got a PhD in philosophy of science, and he got that from Cambridge. He's another big gun in this field. And I would say to you, go listen to an interview with this guy, and you tell me if he sounds like, duh, I don't know how smart people think. I just thumped my Bible. No, this dude is sharp. He understands. Yeah, his philosophy is in, I'm sorry, his PhD is in the philosophy of science. So he knows a lot about like the history of science and can sit there and talk about like the different competing views of the Big Bang and how that came to be accepted and all that kind of stuff. But he's very sharp. He understands the standard Darwinian account. He gets all that stuff. And he's just got, I think his one of his books is called The Return of the God Hypothesis. Okay, so I'll link in show notes page, bobmurphyshow.com/319. An interview with the guy from the Hoover Institute, or is it institution? Real soft-spoken, very pleasant guy, but he has him on. It's a great conversation just to see where he's coming from. So some of his stuff, so he goes through the Big Bang thing, showing how historically that wasn't the scientific consensus, and notice that that's consistent with, you know, if the universe had an origin. Let's put it this way. If the universe just always was, then you could just say, well, just that's what it was. But if it had a cause, if it came into being, excuse me, then presumably it had a cause. And then so that leads, you know, to the idea that there must have been something outside the material universe as we know it. He also gets like into the fine-tuning stuff, right? So there's lots of constants of nature and also the initial conditions, things like the charge on an electron, the mass of neutrons and protons and this kind of stuff that, you know, Planck's constant. A lot of these things that if they had been a little bit one way or the other, life as we know it would not be possible. Such that it almost seems as if, like, if there were hundreds of dials that had to be turned to a suit. In other words, the laws of physics would still work if certain physical constants were different. All right. So we're not talking about like, hey, what if F equals MA weren't true? Or, I mean, not worrying about Einstein, but you get the idea. That's not what we're talking about. We're just saying things, again, like the charge on an electron. That's a specific numerical amount. And it could be a little bit lower or higher. And or then there's lots of other things where the laws of physics would still work. And it's just you're kind of turning the dial. This is the way you could imagine another potential universe that still had the same basic laws of physics, but with different values for some of the constants in that universe. And it wouldn't be constant across the universes. Okay. And so the point is there's a lot of these things where the dial, you know, if you looked at the dial and what's the range of, you know, if it can go between 12 o'clock and all the way down to 6 p.m. and all the way back up. And if you look at what's the range of that potential 360 degrees that is consistent with life as we know it, for a lot of those dials, it's a very, very slight little sliver of that pie is where the dial has to be in that range. Otherwise, life doesn't work. And so people, you know, scientists disagree, but there are plenty of reputable scientists who would say you add all that together, or not add them, but multiply them, and it's astronomically low, the odds of that just randomly happening. Okay, and so one response to that that secular scientists want to give is to say, well, that's just stupid. Obviously, if the universe couldn't support life, we wouldn't be sitting here wondering, why are we here? And so the fact that we're wondering why we're here means that you, and well, yeah, that's true, but that doesn't explain anything. Right. So the analogy I heard one guy use was, he was quoting somebody else, is to say, imagine you're like in the World War II and you're in the French Resistance and the Germans capture you and they put you up against the wall and there's 30 German soldiers with rifles and they all aim at you and ready, aim, fire. And they all fire. And, you know, you got your eyes closed and you're like, and you're waiting for the pain or whatever. And you realize you feel fine. You look and the bullets have all hit the wall in an outline around your body. And so if you said, you know, and they're all kind of stunned and, you know, maybe even the guy running the operation, just that freaks him out. So he's like, you know what? Let's just put him back in his cell and we'll talk to our superiors and figure out what to do, as opposed to like going up and sticking a knife in you. Okay. And you're in your cell and you're just kind of befuddled and you're thinking a miracle just happened and you're saying that to your cellmates. And one of them, you know, trained in modern science, says, well, that's stupid. The only reason you're sitting here telling us a story is because you didn't die. So there's no mystery to be explained. Right. That would be stupid for him to say that. Right. Even though it is true, the only reason you're there talking to him is because the bullets all missed you, but that would still be a miracle. Okay. And so likewise, yes, it's true. If all the dials had to be a certain way for us to even be here wondering about it, that doesn't explain why were they like that, right? There's nothing in terms of the standard Darwinian story and Richard Dawkins' view of the world or the universe that says we should be here pondering it. So why are we? And it doesn't explain that to say, well, if we weren't here wondering, then we wouldn't be here wondering. So that's why. That's not an explanation. Okay. The obvious answer that people give is to say, oh, there's the multiverse. And that every possible universe exists. And then in the very vanishingly small fraction where life is possible, life does exist. Or maybe in some of them. And other ones, it just didn't come about, even though it would be sustainable if it did. And then, so that's where we are. Okay, so there, yeah, like if there were a billion POWs all lined up, then maybe, and you survived, it wouldn't be so shocking. And then maybe you could say, yeah, I got lucky, but it wasn't a miracle because given how many, you know, they killed a billion people and I happen to survive. So that's not so shocking. Or like a different, like, when I was younger, I used to go to the driving range with golf. I used to imagine, you know, I'd all be sitting there and I was like, what if, cause you're hitting the balls out in this huge field. And I was like, what if it was just like people had to all stand out there, right? Like the field was just packed with thousands of people packed shoulder to shoulder and, you know, chest to back. And then we're all just sitting here hitting three woods and like the ball's going to fall on somebody's head. But yet if you're some guy out there, you're thinking, no, there's no way I'm going to get hit. What are the chances? But yet with every ball hit, somebody's going to get hit. Right, for whatever reason, that just I would sit there and think about that kind of stuff. I was a weird kid. Right. And so in a situation like that, yeah, it on the one hand, you would think it's very statistically unlikely you're gonna get hit. But on the other hand, somebody's got to get hit the way I set it up. Okay. And so the fact that someone gets hit doesn't prove something crazy happened. Whereas there was just one guy standing out there and you hit him, that would be pretty incredible. Even if you were, you know, Tiger Woods or something. Okay. So that does at least, you know, survive a hurdle in the objection, but still notice what you had to do there. In general, you know, scientists like to talk about Occam's razor and like, oh, you're inventing your sky daddy to explain stuff. And so here, it's just kind of funny that people who very much are, you know, oh, I'm so empirical and I don't, you know, you got some, yeah, you got your sky daddy that's non-falsifiable and maybe there's some invisible demon in the corner that's controlling things. And yet when they're faced with the evidence of an apparently fine-tuned universe, they say, well, maybe there's an infinite number of possible universes that, depending on your framework, even in principle, we couldn't possibly measure. And that's how we're going to explain stuff. I mean, that's that's like literally the most, the biggest violation of empiricism conceivable, to imagine an infinite amount of universes that we can't directly interact with to explain our current observations, right? Okay. Last thing here, and I'll wrap it up. Some people would say, okay, fine. You come up with all this good stuff, and you got some clever people who are mostly like good at arguments. Like you got some good lawyers and philosophers on your team ID, but you're not, what are you doing? Like, what are you producing? You're not doing anything. Okay. So for one thing is it's a question. Why is it that modern science emerged in what we call the West? Right. There were plenty of advances, you know, impressive technological innovations and whatnot, like in Rome, and you know, the Chinese had a lot, like, you know, they had gunpowder and stuff before the white man, things like that. But in terms of what we mean by modern science and empiricism, the scientific method and all that, that clearly came from Europe. And why? And one explanation is that, well, that's where the Judeo-Christian worldview came from, and that was conducive to the development of modern science. You know, so the exact opposite of the standard religion versus science. And oh, poor Galileo, you know, the stupid churchmen made him recant or whatever. And so the theory being, people coming from that tradition believed that the universe was created by a rational, intelligent being, that we were created in his own image, and that the universe should operate according to rational principles. And so it made sense to go look for them. If you didn't think there would be a parsimonious set of rules that governed the material universe, why would you spend all kinds of time fiddling around with paper and drawing ellipses and whatnot and doing experiments, dropping balls and measuring how fast they roll down planes and whatnot? Why would you go through all that unless you thought you were going to uncover the mind of God? Right? So since we come up out of that tradition and we've seen in practice the success of that method, now atheists who are born into that culture and the heritage they've gotten from religious people, they can go ahead and, you know, use their inheritance without caring about the original source. But I'm saying, to explain the origin of science itself, people who are, of course, friendly to the religious tradition say that's one of the reasons. All right, so here's this quote from Newton. So Isaac Newton, clearly an important scientist, arguably the best physicist of all time. All right, like that's an amazing insight to say, what if the same principles that explain, and you know, an apple falling from a tree, whether or not that was real, I don't know, is the same thing that explains the moon, is the same thing that explains, you know, comets and whatnot that we might observe. It's all the same basic force, the same few principles, and I can just write some equations out and explain all of that. That's incredible, the leap that that would take intellectually. All right. He also was an alchemist. He's like a numerologist too. He would go through scripture and try to find hidden codes. And again, he was also an alchemist. He was trying to find ways to turn lead into gold. I don't know if he thought the two were connected. I don't know if he thought part of, if he could find the hidden codes in scripture, like would one of the offshoots of that show him how to turn lead into gold? I don't know if he thought that, but he definitely was into numerology and was looking for patterns in the scripture. And he also was trying to figure out how to turn lead into gold. And he also, you know, was arguably the best physicist of all time. So here's a quote from the Principia, you know, his classic book. "This most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being. This being governs all things, not as the soul of the world, but as Lord over all, and on account of his dominion he is wont to be called Lord God," and there's some Greek word, "or universal ruler." Okay, so, you know, you could dismiss that and just say, oh, yeah, it's just, you know, Isaac Newton maybe liked certain types of spices and he liked a certain coffee and he liked God and he also was really good at finding F equals MA. And I'm saying, no, I don't think those are unrelated. That because he thought of God in this way, that's what, you know, given his talents and his ease with numbers and whatnot, Newton was able to discover Newtonian mechanics. Okay, but to give a more recent example, this junk DNA, right? So it used to be, I want to say like in the mid 20th century, this idea of junk DNA was big. And the idea was, oh yeah, most of the human genetic code. By the way, I kind of glossed over that. Just the fact that we call it the genetic code, that's where all the stuff with computer science is coming in. Okay, and a lot of these results about like information has to come from somewhere, conservation of information, that kind of thing. That there's some results in information theory and computer science about the complexity of systems and the informational content, and you can't take a system that doesn't have a lot of information, then it turns into a more information-rich system without some external intelligence being involved. All right, that's the idea. So I don't know enough about that to independently give my stamp of approval on that, but I'm just saying those are the kinds of claims being made. And so the fact that atheist biologists matter-of-factly refer to it as the genetic code of DNA, like that's showing that, you know, the metaphors they're coming up with, or maybe they're not even metaphors, you know, there's informational content packed into these cells. And so the question is, where's that coming from? And so they say, oh, well, it came from the environment. And that's what, you know, the shape of the hills and the fact that, you know, there's predators and whatever. And that's why these proteins are all folded in this, and that's the idea. There's like, no, there's a disconnect there. Those causes are not sufficient to explain the outcome. That's the claim. Okay, but anyway, the stuff with junk DNA, that earlier in the 20th century, people thought most of the genetic code, or a lot of the genetic code, I don't say most, was, quote, junk, and wasn't there. And then they thought that was a strike against creationism, right? You know, which, why would an intelligent God give you all of this wasted DNA that doesn't do anything? Or, I don't know if it's RNA and that kind of stuff, the non-coding portions. And then over time, there have been more and more developments where there's like, oh, actually, this stuff that we used to think was junk isn't, and here's what it does, and da-da-da-da. All right, so I'll link to that, a discussion of that. I'm not nearly competent enough to even try to summarize it. you know, there's discussion. I'll link to the, you know, the guy quotes from leading journal articles saying, "Ah, yes, we've, you know, our views on this are evolving," and that, no pun intended. All right, so this isn't some obscure creationist at some third tier university biology department at a Christian school saying this. You know, this is a guy quoting from stuff in leading scientific journals. So that's just one example of, you know, somebody who believed that our cells were designed by an intelligent being would have been more likely to persist in the hypothesis that, no, this so-called junk DNA probably has some purpose behind it, right? So I'm not saying the advances in this field were by people who work for the Discovery Institute. But I'm just saying this is an example, like, to show that how science is progressing is more towards the ID camp, and that if you wanted to say, you know, what good would it be if I went into my lab armed with the ID approach? Well, that's one obvious example. Last one I'll say is, unfortunately, I didn't, when I listened to it, it made perfect sense and I filed it away and I typed a note to myself, but I hope I can remember it now. It had to do with woolly mammoths, and I think it was like this. I think the idea was that originally they thought that, oh yeah, there was the predecessor, and then there must have been random mutations that gave it longer and longer hair, and then that's how you got the woolly mammoth. But then now they did more research, and I think now the leading hypothesis is that it was more that, no, there was a mutation that turned off a thing that made the hair stop growing like that, right? And so you might say, like, well, it's, you know, six of one, half dozen of the other, who cares? But no, the point was, and the guy did a better job explaining than I'm doing right now, that the difference of, well, no, see, that the ability to be a woolly mammoth was programmed in all along, and this was more like something had to be turned off, like, you know, some enzyme that inhibited the fur, the growth of the fur or something like that. And that could shut off so that this potential inside of it to turn into a woolly mammoth was allowed to be activated. And that's different from saying, no, there was no woolly mammoth blueprint in that DNA earlier, and then the environment just poured it in there step by step over time. You know, so that's a different story from the blueprint for building a woolly mammoth was in there all along, but some switch had to get randomly turned to allow that program to execute. Okay, so you see the difference there? Okay. Well, that's a good place, especially since I'm losing my voice. To wrap up, again, go to bobmurphyshow.com/319. I'll give you links to all this stuff if you want to follow up on them, but I hope I've whetted your appetite. Thanks for your attention, everybody. See you next time.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.